Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday the 15th of August, these are our main stories. India's Prime Minister says the scrapping of Kashmir's special status is a major achievement. A last-minute request by the United States has temporarily blocked the release of an Iranian oil tanker which was seized last month off Gibraltar. And the remarkable escape of passengers and crew on board a Russian airliner that made an emergency landing in a field. Also in this podcast.
Wherever I tread, I've got to be careful that I don't step on dinosaur bones. This bone here, for instance, is the shoulder blade. If you reach over and feel yours, it's a few inches long. This is over 2 metres.
The team walking with dinosaurs in the US. The Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, has called the decision to revoke Kashmir's autonomy a major achievement of his government. In a broadcast to mark India's Independence Day, Mr. Modi said he recognised the importance of keeping everyone in the region happy.
My fellow dear Indians, Jammu and Kashmir can become an inspiration for prosperity and happiness for the rest of the country. It can provide a major contribution for the development of India. We should work towards helping Kashmiris to celebrate their traditional ways of life. We should all help the state. The new system we are setting up should be able to achieve that.
The country is on high alert and security heightened at all major airports amid rising tensions with Pakistan. The disputed territory has been in lockdown since Delhi's decision and hundreds of people have been locked up. In a moment, we'll hear from our correspondent in Delhi. First, though, what a reaction in Pakistan to what Mr. Modi had to say on India's Independence Day. Sikandar Kamani is our correspondent in Islamabad.
What the media channels here are mainly talking about is an announcement by the government and the authorities for today to be commemorated as a black day. We've seen some protests where people are releasing black balloons and waving black flags in solidarity, they say, with Kashmiris in India. And also there's been a focus on an announcement by the United Nations Security Council that it will hold a closed-doors meeting on the Kashmir issue on Friday, which Pakistani officials are seeing as some kind of victory for their diplomatic offensive.
Our correspondent Rahul Tandon is in Delhi and was listening to Mr. Modi's speech.
People really now digesting what the Indian Prime Minister said as he stood up in his traditional Indian white kurta and spoke in Hindi for 92 minutes. About 10 minutes of it was probably around Indian-administered Kashmir and events there. Mr. Modi, as he always does, trying to portray himself as the strong man of India, a man who's making decisions that previous prime ministers have been too scared to take. He touched on the autonomy issue, said it had just led to nepotism, corruption and injustice, and also to his critics and said, look, if you thought it was such a good idea to have this Article 370 that gave the area more autonomy, why did you not make it a permanent status as well? I think it's a message that's going to go down very well with the Indian public. I think the really interesting part of the speech was 92 minutes. One word was not used at all, Pakistan. Another 2 years were not, 2 year words were not used, Imran Khan.
It's interesting that you suggest that this will all go down well with the Indian public over what's going on in Kashmir.
Yeah, look, I think there's always been, since the start of this crisis, if we use that word to describe it, when they made the decision last Monday, two very differing narratives here. There is the narrative of India, where people support the Prime Minister's decision in a huge way. I think many people in India have been frustrated with what's been taking place in India-administered Kashmir over the last decade, with the violence, with what they see as a rise in extremism, and they felt it was time for action to be taken. The problem is that within the Kashmir Valley, where the majority of the Muslim community live in Indian-administered Kashmir, we're certainly getting a sense that that isn't the feeling. But the lockdown remains there, Jackie. On day 12, the internet is still cut off, whilst the rest of India is able to go out on the streets and discuss the Prime Minister's speech. That isn't the case in Indian-administered Kashmir.
That was Rahul Tandon speaking from Delhi. Next to a developing situation in Gibraltar, where a last-minute request by the US has temporarily blocked the release of an Iranian oil tanker, which was seized last month off Gibraltar. The Grace One was accused of smuggling oil to Syria. The captain and crew were held and their passports seized. My colleague Dan Damon has been speaking to our diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus.
It raises many, many more questions than it answers. On the face of the reports, the Americans seem to be calling for the ship in some sense to be handed over to them, that they want to seize the ship. That's not entirely certain. But, of course, the difficulty we have here is that, for all intents and purposes, the vessel looked as though it was going to be released today. The Gibraltarian authorities have made that clear. The captain and three of the officers of the vessel were released from detention. All the indications were that that ship would have been released. And of course, the hope was that that in some way would clear the way for Iran to release a British flagged vessel, the Stena Impero, that they had seized subsequently. The American Justice Department's late intervention, as I say, raises all sorts of questions. Did the British and the Gibraltarians know that this request was coming? What exactly is the basis legally of the American demand? And is it going to be determined today? The court has adjourned, but as I say, it muddies the waters. And it seems to have derailed, to mix the metaphors, a process that was already on its way to some kind of conclusion.
The court will reconvene in about 4 hours' time. I suppose they could just say to the Americans, well, thank you, we've considered your request, but no.
Well, they could indeed. Of course, the worrying thing is the noise is off, the kind of context in which all this happens. It's a very delicate situation with Iran. The tensions in the Gulf, the seizure of this British flagged vessel and so on. As I say, the choreography was in place. The Iranians themselves over recent days have been making positive sounding noises and so on. If it's seen that at the last minute, the United States certainly maybe unbeknown to the British and the Gibraltarians has intervened in this way, if it throws a spanner in the works, I think that is only likely to, it's likely to cause considerable tension between Britain and Iran. And I think it's only likely to up the tensions again in the Gulf region itself.
That was Jonathan Marcus. The Chinese ambassador to the UK, Liu Xiaoming, has held a news conference to address the political crisis in Hong Kong. Huge pro-democracy demonstrations have engulfed the region for over 10 weeks. Some of them have become violent. Our correspondent Naomi Grimley has more.
The ambassador said Hong Kong was at a critical moment. He said he hoped the chief executive, Carrie Lam, would be able to restore order there on her own. But he warned that if the situation got worse, the central government would not sit on their hands.
Should the situation in Hong Kong deteriorate further into unrest uncontrollable for the government of the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region, the central government would not sit on its hands. We have enough solutions and enough power within the limit of basic law to quell any unrest swiftly.
He also warned Western governments not to undermine the stability of the territory, arguing its prosperity was important to everyone. He went on to blame international media organisations for pouring oil on the flames by radicalising demonstrators with selective reporting.
Our correspondent in Hong Kong is Jonathan Head.
The occupation of the airport, of course, was massively disruptive, and there is some debate even within the protest movement themselves about whether that level of disruption is counterproductive. Some think you've got to make that kind of impact to keep their message coming across. Others say we're losing sympathy, particularly the scenes where we saw protesters lose their cool and attack people that they believed were undercover officers. That was a very ugly moment in what had otherwise been a very idealistic protest movement, and you know, they've issued apologies. Of course, they've given a propaganda gift to the Chinese state, which is demonising them as nothing less than terrorists. But we haven't seen significant protests at the airport since then. We are expecting mass rallies this weekend, so I think the protesters want to make it very clear that they've not given up. There's been no concessions at all from the Hong Kong government, so we're still very much in the same position, I think, that we've been in recent weeks.
That was Jonathan Head in Hong Kong. Officials in Malaysia say a post-mortem examination has found no evidence of foul play in the case of the French-Irish teenager Nora Quarin. The 15-year-old disappeared from a holiday resort on August the 4th. Her body was found on Tuesday following a search through dense jungle. Nora, who had learning difficulties, was on holiday with her family. Mohamed Mat Yusop is the local police chief.
The main reason for her death is intestinal damage. The intestine was punctured, which could be due to starvation for a long period of time and could also be due to prolonged stress.
Our reporter in Malaysia is Howard Johnson.
Details were released today from this post-mortem examination of Nora Quarin's body. Yesterday, a senior pathologist came down from the Malaysian capital, Kuala Lumpur, to carry out this post-mortem examination. Today, at the state police headquarters, there was a press conference in which they said that they believe there was no foul play in the death of Nora Quarin. They said for the time being, there was no element of abduction or kidnapping. That's according to the police chief. Here, they said that they believe that she died 2 or 3 days before they found her body on Tuesday, and said there was no indication of rape or violence, that it's likely that her cause of death was because of a rupturing of her intestine, internal bleeding, because of a prolonged lack of food and stress.
And it does seem that she was missing for some time before she actually died, all the time that that search was going on for her.
Yeah, the family have come out last night with a statement via the Lucy Blackman Trust, which is the charity set up to help British nationals in crisis abroad. And they said that they will be making no more comments at this time. They said that we urge an end to speculation. Please let the family grieve in peace and let the authorities do their job. At the moment, we know that there was a massive search and rescue operation. They did search the area. The police have said that they did search the area before and hadn't found the body of Nora Quarin. She was discovered on Tuesday by a team of hikers, volunteers who were looking in that area, and they found her beside a stream. So it does raise some questions about why she wasn't found on the first sweep by the state search and rescue operation.
Is the investigation over now?
As far as we know, there will be no more police press conferences updating on any element of this search and rescue operation, and then obviously the post-mortem examination that happened after that. Every day covering this story, there has been a lot of media activity at the police headquarters or at the hospital or at the local police station in Pantai, close to where Nora Quarin went missing. But as far as we understand, there will be no more updates for the time being. And as I've said, the Lucy Blackman Trust say that the family will not be talking anymore. We can expect another statement from the Lucy Blackman Trust, and that should be issued a little bit later today.
That was Howard Johnson in Malaysia. Still to come in this podcast.
What a loser now will be later to win, 'cause the times they are a-changin'.
It's 50 years since the Woodstock Music Festival, but why did Bob Dylan miss it? Find out later. Russian media are hailing it a miracle. A passenger plane carrying 233 people made an emergency landing in a cornfield on the outskirts of Moscow after it's thought striking a flock of birds shortly after takeoff. 23 people were injured. Passengers have been posting videos on social media of the landing and saying how relieved they are to be alive.
There was a stony silence on board. Everyone was waiting for their fate. Then the plane hit the ground hard. I held my baby in my hands. I was afraid she'd be shaken badly because she's so light.
Our Moscow correspondent is Steve Rosenberg.
You said that it's being described as a miracle, and yes, it is. But I think, you know, instead of miracle, we should talk about the skill of the pilots who managed to bring down this Airbus with damaged engines with a bump, but safely, intact, allowing the more than 230 passengers and crew to get out of that plane alive. So the passengers are relieved. The Kremlin is also celebrating. President Putin's spokesman a few minutes ago said this was a good day, and he called the pilots heroes.
The plane was irreparably damaged, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't think the plane will be flying again. But the fact that everybody got out alive is great news for people here. There's been so much bad news in this country the last few weeks, submarines sinking and explosions in the far north, that a piece of good news is well received here.
Definitely very good news indeed. The cause of this, a flock of birds, how big a problem is that?
Bird strikes are common. They happen almost every day, but planes are built to deal with them and pilots are trained to cope with them. They very rarely end in accidents, but accidents do happen. In fact, 10 years ago, remember that US Airways plane that landed on the Hudson River? That was also described as a miracle, miracle on the Hudson River. That plane had struck, I think, a flock of geese. So it does happen, and it seems to have happened today. There will be an investigation by the Russian authorities, but already the authorities here seem pretty sure that this was due to a bird strike.
That was Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. To Belgium now, where a court is investigating an orphanage for allegedly trafficking children from the Democratic Republic of Congo. The children were brought to Belgium and adopted by families who'd been told they were orphans. James Copnell has been speaking to Kurt Verteleers, a Belgian investigative journalist whose work helped to bring the story to light. He explained how the trafficking ring worked.
One way was providing some kind of holiday camp for the kids that originated from this little town in the north of Congo, sending them on a holiday camp to Kinshasa. For some of the parents, this was a unique opportunity, or at least that's what the organizers told the parents, that it was a unique opportunity for them and for the kids. That was one way to get the kids out of the little town of Gemena. And the second way was plain kidnapping. There were stories, and we've also discovered that, and we've also proven that there were stories where the orphanage just said, it gave details on which kind of kid they would need. Like, for example, we need a 3-year-old or 4-year-old boy by tomorrow, and some kidnapper would go on the streets in Kinshasa and would just grab a kid from the road somewhere.
And then they were then brought to Belgium.
All of the kids that we have tracked down were given fake identities, fake names, fake birth dates of birth already in the orphanage. And they were 3 and 4 years old, and they had to address one another with the new identities. And the new identities were also given to the adoptive parents, so they never even knew what the real names of the kids were. And after some time in the orphanage in Kinshasa, they were transferred to the parents in Belgium, but also in some other countries.
How did the parents, and I suppose you as well, others, start to realize that something was wrong?
The biological parents in Congo, well, they knew right away, of course. You have to realize that the place where they grew up in Gemena, north of Congo, is at 800 kilometers from the capital. There was no way for these poor parents to travel all the way to Kinshasa and to go look for their kids. It was impossible. They lost them. There was no help for them. In this little town of Gemena, they could not go to police. There were no lawyers, no nothing. They were all by themselves. So they knew right after this holiday that the kids would never come back. The kids in Kinshasa that were robbed on the streets in Kinshasa, of course, the parents, they knew right away because, well, the kids never returned home at night. And there were some local organizations trying to locate the kids, but of course, they did not succeed. They only discovered that the kids were gone.
And what about you? Where does your involvement come in?
I've worked for several months under the radar in Belgium and trying to locate some that were involved in the transportation of the kids from Gemena to Kinshasa. I've succeeded in getting in contact with them. And after some time, I traveled with my photographer to Congo, and we've tracked down the parents in Gemena. At that time, the parents, they were not aware that their kids were still alive. life and that they were in Belgium. We could provide pictures of the kids. They recognized their kids. They also gave us a lot of details about their kids, about their life over there. And it all added up. The only thing we didn't have at that time was a DNA proof. But that was where the Belgian Justice Department comes in, because after we returned from our trip to Congo, they went for three times to Congo to get some DNA from these parents, and it all added up. The DNA matches.
Kurt Verteleers was speaking to James Copnell. An international team of scientists has begun excavating a treasure trove of newly discovered dinosaur fossils in North Wyoming in the US. The researchers say the site is so rich in bones, it'll keep them busy for at least 20 years. Already this summer, they've unearthed the remains of four giant animals, along with preserved dinosaur footprints and countless fossil plants. The BBC was given special access to the dig. Here's our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
Stegosaurus was one of the titans of the Jurassic age.
Stegosaurus Sophie.
Nine-year-old American twins Deanna and Kiana gasp in amazement at Sophie the Stegosaurus at London's Natural History Museum.
I think it's really cool. Maybe I wish I could see one in real life, but they're already extinct.
Sophie's dinosaur skeleton was found in the United States in North Wyoming in what's called the Bighorn Basin.
Mission Jurassic.
More than 100 scientists are currently working with the Children's Museum of Indianapolis to unearth new dinosaurs at a secret location they call the Jurassic Mile, an industrial-scale dig to discover fossil bones, plants, and even footprints.
The size and scale of this whole site is breathtaking.
Phil Manning from the University of Manchester is the co-chief scientist on the dig.
There's an embarrassment of riches. That's the biggest problem. We have almost too much bone. Here, we're up to our necks in dinosaur bones. It's ridiculous.
Ah, we're Lone Star on Sirius XM Prime Catcher.
Okay, so if everybody could please turn off their geographical location services on their phones.
The subterfuge on the drive into Jurassic Mile is to ensure researchers have time to properly assess the site. And they're worried about fossil thieves as well. I'm descending into a small quarry that's been dug out of the side of a hill, and everywhere around me there are little flags fluttering in the wind which denote the position of a newly discovered bone. But in front of me there are some huge bones. What am I looking at, Phil?
This is the fossil remains of an enormous sauropod dinosaur. This is the long-necked, long-tailed dinosaurs. It's so rare you get to see so many bones strewn in front of you. This is like pickup sticks, but using dinosaur bones. It's absolutely ridiculously rich.
If you guys want to come down and take a look, we just found some really cool stuff.
London's Natural History Museum is here to find possible new display items. Who knows, maybe another Sophie. Dr. Susie Maidment.
The rocks here are about 150 million years old, and they were deposited by rivers and on floodplains, and they're called the Morrison Formation. The rivers and floodplains were inhabited by dinosaurs that we all knew when we were seven, so Stegosaurus and Diplodocus and Brontosaurus. But up here in the north of the basin, there's an increasing body of evidence to suggest that there are some new dinosaurs and some different ones from those that we find further south, and that's what we're hoping to test at this site here.
Professor Manning says paleontologists dream about sites like this. Not just the huge number of bones, but also their giant size.
Wherever I tread, I've got to be careful that I don't step on dinosaur bones. This bone here, for instance, is the shoulder blade. This is the scapula. If you reach over and feel yours, it's a few inches long. This is over 2 metres in length. It's from an absolute titan.
The Children's Museum of Indianapolis has a 20-year lease to explore this small parcel of Wyoming ranchland. But given the richness of fossils, it's likely those 2 decades will see the scientists barely scratch the surface of what's set to become one of the world's most significant dinosaur dig sites.
Jonathan Amos reporting. And speaking of dinosaurs, Thursday marks the 50th anniversary of the Woodstock Music Festival, one of those landmark moments that helped define the 1960s. But what's often overlooked is that the most famous resident of Woodstock, Bob Dylan, wasn't there. He was in the Isle of Wight off the south coast of England. 50 years on, David Sillitoe has been to meet Ray Folk, the 23-year-old, well, he was 23 then, who managed to convince Bob Dylan to forego Woodstock and help stage the biggest pop festival Britain had ever seen.
Here come the hippies, the advance guard of an invasion force expected to number between 1 and 200,000 from all over Britain and the continent. They're flooding into the Isle of Wight today.
This is the field. This was the arena. The stage was not far from here.
Just here?
Yeah, just to the left.
This is where Dylan and the Beatles were, just here?
Yep, just here.
This is music history we're looking at, isn't it?
Absolutely. Shut the light.
Shut the door. How old were you?
I was 23.
And you were in charge of this?
Well, my brother was 24. We were between.
Oh, he was the grown-up. He was 24.
Well, he was a grown-up in the room, yes. One of my duties was looking after Dylan. I mean, I booked Dylan.
As you do when you're 23.
As you do when you're 23.
Were you a hippie in those days?
No, far from it. And, you know, we put on a very respectable front as businessmen and, you know, wearing a suit and collar and tie and everything, short hair.
How did a bunch of 20-somethings from the Isle of Wight convince Bob Dylan to come here when Woodstock was taking place in his back garden, really?
Well, the fact that Woodstock was taking place in his back garden annoyed him no end. I mean, he was in a reclusive situation in an artist retreat. It was peaceful and quiet and nobody knew about, and suddenly the Woodstock Festival's dumped on it, and he resented it enormously, and he turned his back on it and went away to do his own Woodstock somewhere else, and of course he came here. We are a bit eclipsed by Woodstock, but really, I think it compares with Woodstock favourably because we had the biggest star at that amount to all the other stars put together, as far as I was concerned. We stole Dylan from Woodstock.
What's your name?
Chris Colley.
1969. What were you doing here?
Believe it or not, I was personal chauffeur to Bob Dylan during the festival period. And I said to Abraham, it was a bit of a shock, really.
How old are you?
21 I was then. But, of course, the thing about that is, 21, that sounds quite a mature age, but 1969, 21-year-old from the Isle of Wight, the maturity level was probably more like 15, 16. So it was all quite exciting. Out on Highway 61. We've got a Dylan revival event on the island, and there's going to be bands from various times when Dylan was on the island in 1969.
You're doing it all again, 50 years on?
Doing it all again, but with grey hair, and some of us, no hair.
So the old gang has got back together again for one last event. And it's also a chance to reflect on the feelings of what it was like to be here in 1969.
People kind of looking for some kind of a leader, and that they find it in pop music and in the kind of people who are now their heroes.
The cohorts of the rock revolution coming together and showing their colours, you know? People do feel a brotherhood thing.
I think they're a load of long-haired layabouts who want to go out and do a day's work.
People will be talking about these irresponsible young people. Are you irresponsible?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
The children of the summer's end gathered in the dampened grass.
This is where the real Woodstock happened.
I think so.
It was about more than just music, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yes. It was about, are there ways to make this world work, and are we helping by just slotting in and becoming executives and going to work every day in a suit? So that kind of movement was fantastic while it lasted, but it wasn't very long-lasting.
The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now...
Of course, Dylan had written the theme tune to it. He'd written The Times Are Changing.
They are a-changing.
That report by David Sillitoe, who absolutely isn't an old hippie, just to be clear. As for this Global News podcast, it's all over now, baby blue, but don't think twice. It's all right. There will be an updated version later. If you would like to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, or indeed my weak puns, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.